Hello. Welcome to the Roll Together podcast. Thank you for joining us for these podcast versions of our streamed shows from Twitch. You can always find our schedule of upcoming shows at twitch.tv/RollTogetherRPG/schedule. Please do leave a review, and we look forward to adventuring together. And welcome to Talk Together. Thank you for joining us for an evening of talking about Dungeons and Dragons. I am David Shears, and I will be your host tonight. I'll be chatting to George, who you can see her, and covering some enticing questions and some adventurous anecdotes. What questions, you ask? Well, the dice decide. Before we kick off, this stream will run for approximately 1 hour. We are delighted to be sponsored by Hero Forge, Ultra Pro, Elderwood Academy, D&D Beyond, Level Up Dice, and Warriors of Waterdeep. We are Roll Together RPG on all socials. Massive thank you to our D20 Club on Patreon. Our shows are available as podcasts. Just search Roll Together RPG on your favorite podcasting app. So, without further ado, George, how are you?
Hi, I'm doing all right, thank you. How are you?
Excellent. I'm doing very well, thank you. And lovely to have you on the show. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, what you're doing at the moment in the world of D&D, and anything else you fancy beyond that?
Sure. Yeah, I am George Lockett, as David mentioned. I use he/him pronouns. I am a writer, DM, and a general thing doer is often how I end up describing myself, because there's a lots of different things. So I write for video games. I write fiction of various kinds. You can most as is the way with most of the stuff. Most of the stuff that I'd actually love to shout about is under NDA and will be for some time. But you can see on georgelockett.com, you can see my short stories and other things if you want to check those out. I'm currently I have been DMing Seekers of Elturel Buried after the Roll Together 12 part campaign, and I will be playing in the upcoming campaign, which is terribly exciting. I previously played Ashra Beckett in Icewind Dale Corrupted with Adventurers Wanted last year, and I've been playing D&D for ages, and I love it, and I'm really excited to just spend an hour talking about D&D, to be honest. This is good.
Of course, your favorite ever game must have been playing with somebody and something about an Abbey.
Oh yeah, there was that. Yeah, there, yeah.
It's always enjoyable. Well, fantastic. It sounds like there's a hell of a lot going on. Shall we dive into the questions?
Let's do it. I'm excited.
Let's do it. All right. The first roll. Everyone at home, drum roll in your own time. All right, that is a 3 on the dice. So the question is, what is your favorite character class?
I mean, anyone who knows me or has played with me, they've been chanting wizard from now for the next hour. I could do that if you like. That's good. And I love playing wizards. I love building wizards. I do occasionally play other things, but I definitely suffer from a case of reversion to the wizard, which is like I like a lot of the design stuff about the class, and I like the flavor and the vibe, but also it aligns with the kind of characters I like to play. Like, they usually tend to be like smart, investigative type characters, often like either emotionally repressed or massively socially awkward, which helps. But I definitely, it's almost become a bad habit to the point that it's like my first instinct, like, what wizards haven't I played yet? Or shall I just play one of the same ones that I've already played? I like that style of play. There's that particular kind of, I don't know if you have particular things where it's like, as much as anything else, it is the type of role you play in the party, type of role you play in combat, like that kind of I like big splashy like battlefield control effects, so I almost never deal, I either deal no damage or I deal like fireball damage, that kind of thing. But mostly I like finding smart ways of using spells to mess with the environment, make things harder, and sort of not quite being like the sort of cleric buff type thing, but very much like trying to make the situation better for the party in sometimes subtle ways.
So sort of the archetypal controller.
100%. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Can you think of a time when you've used the wizard in quite an elusive and sort of like you say, sort of a left field way?
The ones for Incorrupted, I think one point there was just we were overwhelmingly like just couldn't, in a situation, an unwinnable fight, like being chased by, I think it was like these sort of strange mutated trolls and frost giants, and it was very much like we could maybe like stall, but we couldn't win. But running through a large enough chamber, just like putting up a very tactically placed wall of force such that they ran into it and couldn't get past, and they could go around it, but because it's an invisible wall, and they're not the brightest creatures, it will take them a little while to figure that out. So that kind of thing where you're sort of carving up the environment. One of my favorite subtle uses is slow, which is like one of the, it can end up being like the least flashy but most effective thing, where it's if you're fighting lots of creatures with multiple attacks and you can just limit them to one attack. Like that makes a massive difference when you're playing at those kind of levels where like multiple monster attacks can be significant swingers to the party, but it's almost invisible. Like you it's not like a big smashy effect. You just like, I'm just going to take away some mechanical things from them for a bit. And I really like well-used places of that. Oh, I've got another one. Sorry, I'm just like, got me talking about spells now.
No, not at all.
This isn't a home game, and it was a similar situation where it was like a sort of unwinnable fight where we are trying to retreat, but through various reasons, I think it was, I'm going to get some of the details wrong, but I think it was someone's familiar and a druid were on the wrong side of a locked door that was barred on the other side, and they were both in shapes that couldn't lift the bar because of the type of animals that they were. Managed to use my familiar flying through the gap to give me, because levitate, which is the spell I used, requires you to, it's an object or creature that you can see within range. And while the bar was on the other side of the door, which I couldn't see, seeing through my familiar's eyes on that side was sufficient for the DM to agree that it's within range and you can see it, so I could use that to levitate the bar out of the way, clearing the way for them to escape, which I quite like. I like little sort of like slight edge cases like that for finding cool ways to use spells.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's like the much maligned prestidigitation. I like trying to find entertaining ways of using that to get out of scrapes or cause distractions. Yep.
Is it much maligned? I feel like everybody loves it, but also it does feel useless in that sense. Like in the sort of big crunchy mechanical sense, it's useless, but it's just so good for flavor.
It's sometimes seen as Minor Illusion's slightly less loved cousin, I think.
Yeah. I think I've almost always, when I've taken Minor Illusion and not prestidigitation, I've almost always wished I had it the other way around. And when I've taken prestidigitation, it just, because it gives you like little slices of lots of things, it's really fun. I think one of the fun uses that I've ended up using it for a bunch in home games is because I think one of the modes is you can heat a material a bit, and you can clean a soiled material, which is always a wonderful phrasing. You drying off someone who is wet is not technically like a literal thing in the spell, but like for something like sure, like your characters have been in the water, it's quite a nice like characterful, flavorful thing. It has no mechanical impact, but it's such a nice thing to be able to go, okay, I will use magic to dry myself out or dry a friend out, and that's like a nice sort of world detail.
It's a good way to build some friendships within a party. You know?
Definitely, yeah.
If the invisible walls aren't doing the job, I can keep them dry.
It's all very the good. Opposite end of the spectrum in terms of spell potency.
Fantastic. All right. Let's see what we got next. Drum roll, please.
I can't do this every time, but I'm going to do the best. Yeah.
Well, as often as you like. Okay, that is a 17. This, I feel, might be a bit of a controversial topic. How do you feel about fudging rolls?
Just can hear me steepling my fingers. I mean, you can see me steepling my fingers. I'm literally doing it. I'm assuming that when I say fudging rolls, I think assumes like the DM doing so, because when you get players fudging rolls, that's a very different kind of equation and there's a different kind of thing. So I'm not even going to think about that. I understand the impulse to fudge rolls. I think it's a, like we can't, when we're DMing, like we can't account for everything in prep, and there's definitely situations. I mean, I found it a lot. Like I've done a lot of DMing. I definitely found like, oh, I massively either, it's usually the times that I'm most tempted to fudge rolls are usually when I have massively over egged a combat encounter or something like that, where I realized like, oh, this could kill them quite easily. That kind of thing where I'm ended up starting to pull the punches, and that's something that I've grappled with in the past. I don't do it anymore. I used to years ago, but I found the more I looked at it, the more I thought about it, and the more it feels like you're taking something away from the players in that kind of sense. But on the other hand, like, yeah, sometimes you cannot, like we're not perfect simulators of what's going to happen at the table. And you know, a particularly lucky or unlucky dice streak for a monster, for example, can be unsatisfyingly lethal. Like it's good for the party to have stakes and all the rest, but sometimes it's like this isn't an interesting fight for them to just be sort of sucker punched to death because I made a mistake in prep. So I definitely get that, but I usually, my solution now is to play with different things. Like fudging hit points is a good one. I'm much happier with that because sometimes it's like that's a thing that feels more, there's like hit points are a spongy thing anyway, like right, all the stuff in the monster stat blocks is averages, and you can roll them up, so it's perfectly, you can bump them or lower them as you want. And sometimes in combat I've just nudged it a little bit because I'm like, this hasn't hit the right level of pacing or that, like where it's not about taking away something from the players or pulling a punch, it's about adding to the narrative by playing with the pacing a little bit. And I feel that is fair game versus dice rolls, where it's very much we have the dice in the game for a good reason, and we don't want to take away from that too much. And the other thing is just like playing with outcomes. Like some of my favorite, there was a thing in a home game recently a couple of months ago now, but recently enough, which the party just got an unlucky streak of dice rolls fighting a beholder. And they were high level characters. Like, that's the kind of fight they could do well, but I think they were down on resources. And it was a case of like just some repeatedly, or I guess lucky rolls on my side of the table, arguably. And
let's
it ends
picture
with
the scene. What had the party just gone through before they arrived?
So this was in a wild magic area. So this was it's a forest near a place they'd been a whole bunch, and there was a big rift that had opened in the sky. Because one of the themes of the campaign, one of the sort of key in fiction sort of arc things, is about. Sort of magical instability and these ur-magical artifacts that are sort of underpinning the fundamentals of magic in this world, and how using them is bad. Using them causes problems and these sort of big storms that cause either wild magic or magic exploding, that kind of thing. So this is a place where that damage had been done. There'd been this sort of fraying to the substance of magic and the world. And that had culminated with this rift opening in the sky. And this forest was superimposed upon a part of another plane. So this sort of big odd pillar field, these pillars of these giant sort of non-earth rock pillars interspersed among the trees as these kind of places got smushed together and made to coexist. And the beholder was from that. And it was this complete, I was going something alien, like it's completely incomprehensible from the point of view of the past. Like, its motives are weird, but it liked to stack things. It liked using its eye rays to make these pillars. It was part of whatever weird ecosystem this other plane had that was not really comprehensible to these characters. And it was very upset that all these trees were not made out of the stone and were not pillars. And it was very upset to find these people who are not pillars or made of stone. So ended up, for various reasons, they ended up battling this while they were trying to find a way of reversing the effects. A fight that they should be capable of, it just ended up that they'd been in other encounters that day, they were down on resources, and it's like that plus rolling those things where I think I rolled either completely useless eye rays or just disintegrate all the time.
At the end of the gauntlet.
Yeah. And I'm like, okay, I didn't, like, it was a sort of sidetrack thing from much of the main story. And I'm like, this isn't a narratively satisfying opponent to defeat them in that kind of way. And, you know, it happened that the dice worked out that two characters got entirely disintegrated by the, sorry, I keep whacking my microphone with the thumb, gesticulating that much, by the beholder. And I'm like, okay, that's not good. That's the kind of situation where I'm like, well, this isn't a villain that's been built up throughout the campaign. This isn't someone where there are personal narrative stakes beyond like solving the situation. And I don't want it to be a like, well, now you're dead. Like, and they're not quite the level where they have true resurrection. So that's a real, like, that's not a good end to it. So I'm like, you know what? I can fix this somehow. So I literally, we were doing it on, Zoom as basically all games are at the moment. I was like, give me 5 minutes just to like disconnect, think about this. And pretty quickly, I'm like, no, this is like playing with what the monster wants. Like, this thing doesn't want to kill them per se. It wants to make them like the rest of this weird structure. And it used disintegrate. So I had it and become, and there's a sort of narrative basis for this in that it's a wild magic area. Weird shit can happen and that's okay. So I had it literally reconstitute those two characters as like mini, like cuboids, like out of, they disintegrated them, reduced their atoms to this sort of stone substance, and it made them into pillars, and they basically learned to think themselves back into their own shape. And they had a temporary run while and if they could be restored to the right kind of restoration magic used as they were collapsing this sort of interplanar distortion, they could be restored to flesh. So that was interesting. That was good because I didn't have to fudge any dice rolls. I didn't have to deal with like two very unsatisfying character deaths. It became like, okay, this is a setback and a narratively interesting thing that's also quite funny. And they had to go forward from that. They also, there was a detriment because they lost all of their mundane equipment, which was quite a lot of things.
There's got to be consequences, right?
Yeah, that's it. So it's about finding that balance where I'm like, I don't want it to be like kid gloves. Like, I mean, okay, some games that's fine. Some games that's what you want. I don't like playing or running those kind of games where it's all kid gloves. No, there's no threat in that sense. But also I don't like just like every encounter is punishing and everything. Like, even if you have a chance of being defeated, I want there to be an and then kind of thing, except in those big climactic sort of arc or season sort of ending encounters where there are personal stakes and it's okay. If a villain defeats you, that's rooted in the story of the campaign rather than something that feels more aside. So like, yeah, that's a long way away from fudging roles, but that's the kind of thing, like looking for different solutions to those problems, because often they are better just than doing simple things.
Yeah. And it doesn't rob players of their agency as well. Which
it makes the world feel more lived. I think fudging rolls. The last thought on that is just that sometimes the biggest thing for me is sometimes it reveals. It's a good. Like, it's like when you flip a coin between two things and you ignore the result. You just look at what you feel when the coin's in the air. Like, you want the thing. Sometimes I understand the impulse on there on sort of lower stakes combat things, but usually that's more about for me. You know, an example of that is like an investigation role or something where there's information you want the players to have and that you need them to have a little bit of to move the story forward, but you still want those roles to be impactful. So it's about like, you know, you could give a lower investigation role a piece of the same information, just couched with less flavor, couched with different things to sort of make sure you're moving people forward without taking away from the role the dice are playing in the game.
I'm just fixating on the faces of your players as they were disintegrated.
Yeah.
And then...
I mean, the last campaign with that group ended with a TPK because things went very... just escalated bad. I don't think they... like, they made a series... this was at the end of a long series of mistakes that they had made, but it still got down to, like, two characters down, what the last one up, fighting a very tough opponent for, like, an ancient white dragon. And, like, they still had a shot. Like, they were trying to capture this thing and they'd been given these sort of magical... essentially... pokeball analogs that, you know, the more status conditions they impose, the lower its hit points, the more chance they had of effectively banishing this thing to a cell. And it came down to the monk like just leaping through the air, bringing this thing down. It had burned through all its legendary resistances. It needed a 17 on the dice to pass the save. And I told them that, and I just rolled it right out there on the table, and it came up 17, and like that was it, because they, you know, they couldn't. You know, there was another round, but they were in that death spiral, and I'm like. There were ups and downs of that, but like it felt like it was a good moment. I don't like that it ended in a full party wipe, but we found ways of moving forward from that. But
these are the stories that players will tell years after the event, though. Right. Like, these are the moments that stay with you for sure.
Yeah, I have that dice roll burned vividly in my memory. Like on yeah.
But speaking of end games, you have just wrapped up a epic 12-part series. Was there any moment in the grand finale that made you worry for your players' safety?
Yeah. I mean, that's interesting. Like, part of the what happens in the last session, like so it's an interesting. So just to wind back a little bit on that, Seekers of Eldraine Buried. Because one of the things I was channeling in that campaign was like an Indiana Jones style like adventure story. There's a very much like getting into the sort of in this case a demiplane, sort of this strange and distant and wild place. Getting there. Getting a thing, getting out was part of it. So for me, the big sort of battle with the guardian of the plane was the big set piece fight that often I think for normally if I was structuring a 12 part series like this, I'd stick in the last or penultimate episode. Like I'd put it a bit towards the end because that's where you want that to land. But because like escape from the hedge maze was meaningful, I wanted to stack that a little bit earlier such that there were still interesting opportunities. Like who makes it out? What do they do about it? And actually they completely botched that challenge. That's great. But then that meant there still need to be interesting things to come out of that last session. Like you don't want it to feel like too much of a downbeat. And that was bringing the artifact home and starting to get to grips with the secrets they had learned and the things that like everything back home is not all what it seems. I wanted an encounter that wasn't, I mean, so one of the sort of background things is an archfey. The archfey who want this artifact that's in the demiplane have been orchestrating this, and one of the things that has set the party on the path to get it is an archfey sort of shadow puppeting behind the character that sent them on this. And they knew enough to call the archfey there, and actually like they're opposed to them. Like they don't want to just hand this over now that you know there's shenanigans afoot. But also like they're level 8 characters at that point. They can't realistically fight an archfey, and nor would I want them to. Like it's not interesting to again. It's the previous question. It's not interesting at that point to go, cool, you all die because you can't win. But also I wanted something that felt like a challenge and a threat, so that there that encounter had some rules in the sense that the archfey comes there. She could just wipe the floor with them. She could fight them and destroy them. There's nothing stopping her from doing that, except that because of the rules of the sort of fairy pacts that have put this in place in the first place, if she does that, she can't take the artifact. She can't take it from them by force, and she can't use overt coercion to do that. So there's that nice, like, that sense of threat where she has to use a different tack, so that matches and brings them down to the level more of the players. And that worked out beautifully. I had no idea how that was going to go. They sort of could have bypassed that. They could have done all kinds of things, but it worked out beautifully with most of the characters being frozen in place and the one who's learning to be more of an adult, Veracity, who's like coming into this, standing up for the rest of her friends.
Brilliant character.
And doing so, insulting the archfey, which is like very much like, okay, cool, she can repay a fair insult. Like she can do something about that. And that's not coercion on the rules. So that's very much like that twist. And again, that becomes a narrative threat. Like it's not interesting for her to turn around and, you know, meteor storm, I don't know, something ridiculously out level, but imposing some kind of interesting narrative constraint that pushes the... it's an interesting note for the end of that campaign, that the payoff doesn't come then, it comes in the future, if we can bring these characters back. I can't remember what your original question was. I feel like that was
whether there were any nerves around the end game and how it might go.
Yeah, I was worried that there wouldn't be enough of a climactic sort of feel to it. Like, how do they handle it? I mean, they could have just come in and go, "Yep, cool, Archway, whatever, take it, that's fine." And again, that's a lived character choice. That's all good in many ways. But I'm like, I wanted something that felt like it had that drama and tension in the same way that the previous few episodes did, so it wasn't like a full-on downbeat at the ending. I think that kind of thing.
Well, yeah. Coming from me, who is admittedly biased, I thought it was a great end to a great great story arc. So
wonderful, thank you.
Oh, fantastic, thoroughly enjoyed it. All right, let's roll this dice. Don't worry, there's no more drum rolling required.
Yeah, no, it's a good thing that you're rolling these dice and not me, otherwise it'd just be ones every time. We'd answer the same question or whatever however many times.
if the same number does come up, I will roll it again rather than us taxing you with coming up with an entirely different answer.
The parallel timeline versions where I have to pretend they aren't.
Insofar as possible, we'll try and stay on some sort of narrative arc, you know. It's just like any D&D session or talking about D&D, it can go off on its own tangent. We'll just see how we roll with it.
And the dice are definitely on our side and not out to get us.
Well, that is true, yeah. It's the one occasion when a nat one is not necessarily a bad thing to have.
That's true, yeah.
Okay, so we have rolled a 6, and that is, how did you start playing TTRPGs? I assume everybody knows that TTRPG is tabletop role-playing game, but just in case you didn't, now you do.
There it is, D&D and the super category thereof. I started playing D&D technically when I was about 10, I think, which is quite a reasonable length of time ago now. I was visiting a friend whose dad had played D&D while he was at university, and he still had his like perfect graph paper handwritten sort of very engineer-esque notes with all the maps and everything for all the dungeons he'd run there, and he ran a game for me and my friend, and I was like, this is really cool. And I'm not 100% sure what edition that was, but it must have been second or something like that from the kind of time period it was.
Do you remember what class you played?
I do not sad, like I wish I remembered more about the actual specifics of that game, because that is sort of like origin story, backstory stuff.
The love affair with wizards began.
Yeah, I mean, it's not impossible, to be honest. Like, I would almost definitely have gravitated towards it. And then at school at some point, I remember people were sort of playing a consequences-esque game where it was very much like one person was like, very much like a sort of proto, I don't think anyone had heard of RPGs in this kind of thing, but very much the proto kind of thing. Like, you're in a room and there's a door over there. You like sort of Zork-esque, but narrated by one person to one other person. No dice, no, like it was just one person making decisions. I'm like, people, this was fun. If you like this, you might. There's this thing called D&D that I've heard of that might be good. So I ended up getting like the third edition starter pack or something like that, and became therefore the perpetual DM, as the person who had the most experience of a grand total of one sessions. Ended up
it's
doing
always
that.
The way, yeah,
yeah. And as being the case at that time, I think we wouldn't be able to play for like 4, 5, 6 months at a time, and then we'd play for an entire weekend pretty much nonstop. Like, sleep was very much a begrudging necessity at some point, which was very good for like learning to sort of improv a bit, because you can't well, you probably can, but it's infeasible to prep 24 or 48 hours of content in a single stretch without any kind of downtime in the middle. So that was kind of good. So that was like the old third edition days. And then I kind of kept, like, from there, I sort of got a little bit into around when the New World of Darkness books came out. I played a little bit. I ran a forum game of Vampire the Requiem for, I think it was about 15 at the time, 14, 15. And I'm pretty sure most of the others, all the players who were in this thing were like 30-year-old software engineers or something. But I was one of the things, I think, but like that was something that got me like writing early on, and I think I sort of I credit it for like just starting to get me thinking in that kind of way. And then sort of didn't play very much going into university, even though I kept the books around. I was like, I will eventually get people to play this, and never did. And then afterwards started running another third edition game with people. And I was kind of like, I was kind of done. Like, I kind of reached the point where I'm like, I've done a lot of this, and I'm kind of like, I'm ready to not do that. But fifth edition came out, and the friends who I played third edition with, some of them were like, let's have a go. And I'm like, yeah, yeah, right. And I completely fell back in love with it because it shucked out so much cruft, so much admin, and like things. Yeah, I mean, like you look at being a wizard in third edition or 3.5, and it's like you need actuarial tables to figure out, because you'd have like a billion spell slots for a start, and you'd have to prep. I don't know if you're playing them or not, but you have to prep like 1-1. Like if you had 6-7 level 1 spell slots, you'd have to have, I will have Featherfall in this slot, and I will have Magic Missile in this slot, which is, I mean, I get that. It fits the flavor of the wizards, and like very much they are preparing the spells. That is a thing, and that made there was more distinction with like a sorcerer who, as a spontaneous caster, who didn't have to match them in that way. That they felt more distinct than they do now. But also, like, that's really dull. Like, there's so much work. Like, what they have, like, I think fifth edition is consistently focus on what is fun and like empowering the players in bigger, splashy ways while also simplifying things like proficiencies. Like, I look at the skills list from third edition, it's like, yes, we will have move silently, and we will have hide, and we will have use rope, and we will have innuendo, and we will have like millions of these things, which you have specific like individual numbers and calculations for half numbers. And I'm like, at the time that was fun. Like, be clear, like I'm not knocking that per se, but also like having gone this long playing fifth edition, looking back at them, like, oh, that's so, it didn't add anything relative to the complexity it induced. So pretty well, yeah, I fell back in love with fifth edition and have been playing a lot ever since, and happily doing so. Yeah,
fantastic. I remember 3.5. I was exposed to it through the Baldur's Gate BioWare games.
Yeah, yeah.
And having to try and pick spells. This was the first time I'd ever played any kind of a CRPG, and the first introduction I had to Dungeons and Dragons, other than like my brother's AD&D book from like the 80s.
Yeah.
And I just looked at that and I was like, I don't know, put it away for like 20 years, and then suddenly
Baldur's Gate. I missed that out. Yeah, I know. I played Baldur's Gate as one of the things that I think that was around the same kind of time when I was starting to get into it, and that was a good like, hey, here's a thing that is D&D. I love D&D. Let's try that. And I remember it just being really hard. I think it's like it's either second edition or AD&D rules, so it's even more like you've got. I to this day I do not know what a THACO is. Like the like that's the sort of proverbial number that governs those things. I recognize it on the screen. I understand broadly what sort of it's like number go low, number be good. But like
the rules are a mystery. Split down the middle at this point.
Yeah. Yeah.
Hey, that arcane knowledge.
Yeah. But I think a lot of that stuff, like a lot of this sort of the background of learning to do D&D, I think it helps me become interested in storytelling, and like Baldur's Gate was a big part of that as well. Like, particularly the first one, like I still like, but that was never landed for me in the same way. Baldur's Gate 2, like the storytelling in that was one of the sort of the feelings that I want to bring both into, like, I mean, I write for video games. That's one of the things that made me interested in that, but also just D&D and bringing that kind of energy to it, and that like the feeling of, I just remember like vividly this the feeling of having relationships with other characters in this world, like this, and it's all text. There's so little voice acting in there. I mean, there is some voice acting, though. That's not quite, not entirely fair. And the voice acting is very good, but like just drawing that out from that and having it feel so much more vivid than in many cases like video game writing, when it's like all voiced now. So some games, if I mean, that's a whole other tangent which we don't need to get on about me talking about video game writing. But like that was a big part of like forming who I am and what I do now, which is kind of weird.
We're throwing some love out to all the voice actors out there.
Yeah, which is, no, you did great work.
Fantastic. So, did you always enjoy writing your own modules, or did you start off playing adventure books and this sort of thing? Or
originally, I think it was all like for the sort of starter pack. There was like a little like dungeon crawl type thing with a map, which I think I probably still have somewhere around. But other than that, I pretty much just made everything up, and that was I was very much like from the sort of the consequence of school kind of, and then I didn't have a grand plan at that point, which is for better and worse. Like I definitely got used to, and that shows through now. My home games I tend to run. I do have a plan now. Like I have like either, you know, thematic stuff, or like I have big story beats in the world that I'm driving towards. But a lot of what happens between is meandering around and letting stuff happen, which is quite fun, because I find that a good outlet for, like, I mean, as someone who does, like, for most of my creative projects, there is a long lead time on, like, I have an idea, I want to make the idea, and that's gonna, like, I have to find room in all my other projects. I have to like go through the hard stuff of like concepting and writing and editing and all that kind of, whereas if I have an idea, sometimes I'm like, I'll just put that in a D&D game, like I can do that next week, that's great, and you get to scratch that itch and do cool stuff and people get to see it and hopefully make people happy, and that's fun. But for fifth edition, we started out with Horde of the Dragon Queen, I think, was the first thing we did, for just sort of get ease into fifth edition. I have played a couple of the others that escape me currently, but mostly I will crib some particular things from the books when necessary, but mostly I like having that I like the feel of like learning a book. That's a very wizard thing, isn't it? Like, you know, ingesting the contents of a book and like and making that your own and for an audience. And there's something sort of mid-low prep about that. But I just like making my own worlds. I like coming up with my own stories and characters and seeing where it goes.
It's like a real life Melf or Tasha. You know, take a spell.
yeah.
Put my own brand.
Just put my little George's Magic Missile. And say,
fantastic. All right. Let's go to the dice. Back to reality. What do we got? We have got an 11. And 11 means, who is your favorite character?
I think this is a cheat because it's no. It just says character. It doesn't say player character. It doesn't say character I've played. So I'm going to go with there's a character in my current home game that I'm running who is a storm giant called Thunderhead, and he's like he's sort of. I mean, there's a whole in fiction, like, you know. Actually, no. To be fair, we talked about the sort of the magical underpinning stones that underpin magic in this world. He's part. He runs an organization that's about like protecting these things from misuse. Mm. But he's become the group's dad. Like, because he was a sort of quest giver essentially at first, more or less. But I'll see if I can get his voice done. But he's like a very low energy, dramatic. Like, well, he was hoping we could to do it differently, but I suppose that's like, because he just has this like very wonderful, like, understage low energy, except when he cuts loose, which is awesome. But he's just like, whenever they have a problem now, it's like, Thunderhead, what should we do? Like, they just like, quick, send a message to Thunderhead. We got to find out. And he's like, I don't know, like, make decisions. You're grown ups.
Good, like, off the top of your head, best or most seminal Thunderhead moment?
I mean, there was a recent session where they got attacked by a bunch of frost giants who had been... whenever I describe, like, random moments from D&D game, it feels like someone, like, feverishly telling you about the comic they read once, that, and you're just like, I don't know, like, what? So they were attacked by a bunch of frost giants who'd been mind-controlled by a person they thought was an ally to come after them. And that's, I think, one of the few times they've seen Thunderhead actually cut loose, because storm giants are chunky, like, powerful sap block creatures. But he's like, he doesn't, like, he's not big on fighting, he's very much like, no, that. And when they've seen him fight, it's been very much just like, that kind of like the Hulk-esque thing where it's like you end the fight immediately. That's kind of you're just so overwhelmingly bad. But this is the first time he's like giant versus giant, and he just had this like adorable, like, well, I think he took down the Frost Giant Everlasting One in close quarters combat, and just turns around and gives a little shy like look to the group, like, just want to see that they saw that, because like I like these people and I value what they think of me. So yeah, like, he's adorable. He's been a
lovely.
I think I put him in intending for one of those characters you put in probably for like a few sessions, or as someone who is like someone they return to, and like they're a persistent character in a campaign, but they're not like main stage necessarily. And he's ended up traveling with them quite a lot, which I quite like. Like, I always used to resist. I don't know about you, where you sit with this, but I think I always, particularly when I started out, I was very much, I would like push back on NPCs traveling with the party too much, because it's more overhead, more things to track and more things in common, like, which is still all true. Like, it's more work, but like having a DM voice in the campaign is useful. So you can say, you could stop doing that and do the other thing. But
today.
yeah. Maybe we could just focus on the story. No, not quite. But yeah, that's exactly like that's also fun. But having and having that character change out over time as well is a good way of changing up the group dynamic, particularly I run quite a small home games, only three players at the moment, so having another voice in that party is quite interesting. Another character I will shout out to, because I think this is possible. I was so excited to introduce this character. Like, it was one of the things you come up with like really early in the campaign. It's like, this won't be relevant for a year. Who is called Apostate, who is a mind flayer, who essentially like hates being part of the, like knows it's horrible, like knows how horrible mind flayers are, because they're horrible tentacle monsters that go around devouring people's brains. And the Elder Brain, I think typically in the fiction, the Elder Brain has like pretty much direct control over every mind flayer within a certain radius, but they can still send them out on missions where they have slightly more autonomy. So Apostate lobotomized itself to cut off connection to the mind and cut off its psionic powers at the same time to escape from this, and was like set up as a, while the characters were dealing with a different problem, the real villain in this situation sort of pointed them at the creepy monster that was said to live in the fishing nets down by the shore and was potentially abducting people, as like, ha, that is the villain over there. And they went along with it and found them, found Apostate, and was like, they cottoned on that something wasn't right, like the Apostate had been rescuing the people who'd been attacked and incapacitated by the actual evil Mind Flayers, and was desperately trying to like survive on the big thing with Mind Flayers is I have a fan theory about Mind Flayers, which is that there's various problems with D&D's approach to like always, I mean other things as well, but like, you know, X species is evil inherently, that kind of thing. Yes, Mind Flayers are positioned that way and they fall into that bracket, but like there's a thing in the Mind Flayer lore which is that they consume brains, and they have to consume brains to live, and they acquire little shards from the brains. And at the one point, the group were trying to solve the problem of like Apostate is our friend now. Like they befriend Apostate, bring it on board, and actually like this is a person who's trying. Like this is a person who's trying really hard to not be part of this horrible entity. But the problem is like, how do you feed it? Because they can't survive on like, you know, mice and other things. They can't do it. So they briefly float to the idea of like, what if it's only like convicted evil people who they eat the brains of? And they're like, well, there's other problems with that for a start. Yes, but also like, given that they slowly acquire traits from the things they're eating, even if you try and be the ethical consumption Mind Flayer, you'll slowly take on negative traits from the people. If you only eat bad people, you're going to turn out bad. But Apostate is a magnificent character, even if I picked a terrible, like really guttural voice. Because last thing. Sorry, this is me enthusing too much about one character. Yeah, but I think this is somewhere in maybe Volos as well. Like on the like, Mind Flayers don't tend to speak because they have telepathy and deep speech. They can speak if necessary, but if they have to speak other languages, they use their tentacles. They insert them into their mouth to act, and their throats to act as vocal cords. And Apostate removing its ability to communicate psionically or telepathically can't talk. So like has this like horrible laryngeal voice that's it's been a while. I mean, for various reasons, Apostate's not around anymore. But
I stalk like this in the back of my throat, and everything is hoarse and painful.
And again, that's fine for a one session NPC. Yeah. But then it's like, we have adopted Apostate, and it now comes with us every session. I'm like, we're going to have to talk about that.
Yeah,
but canonically, in deep speech, it sounds very sophisticated down here because it's just an artifact of the physical, the ick factor of the throat.
Yeah, I mean, if you're gonna have NPCs, like you might as well have not your run of the mill NPCs.
Yeah,
and that chance to explore. I totally agree. Like the chance to explore the aberrations within the stereotypes and non archetypal monsters, and that's one of the things that Tasha's brought in, I suppose, is the thing about bartering with monsters and also henchmen. I need to ask for a reformed illithid henchman.
It's a strong character type. The party took to the character really well, which is exactly why. That's one of those like absolute like sweet moments where it's like, this thing I've been playing for ages, they finally get to see it, and it's a hit. That's good.
If it's gonna be, if it's a hit, always good. And I guess if it's a miss, it's just a question of like, oh, it's never a miss. Yeah. It's fine.
There are other characters.
Fantastic. All right, let's rock and roll. That was not intended to be a terrible
pun.
Dearie me, what an awful pun. I mean, I managed to resist saying, did Thunderhead have a giant double-handed battle axe? And did somebody say, get to the chopper at some point? I managed to resist that, but somehow the Freudian terrible joke slip.
I'm going to use that one now. Yeah.
That's it, manifest itself. All right. Oh, it's an 8. This might be a bit of a controversial one, but a bit divisive one. How do you feel about PvP?
You'll probably be unsurprised to learn that I have many feelings about PvP. I think in some ways it is completely not unique in that, like everything else with tabletop games, like as long as everybody's on the same page and everyone knows what the safety tools are and everyone everyone has shared expectations, then it's fine. I think PvP is unlike other things in that if you have not set those boundaries, if you have not set those expectations, then it has more potential for upset than your average like whatever other thing, because the people tend to be very heavily emotionally invested in their characters, or in many cases living acting their characters very, very deeply. So that's the kind of thing where I think the expectation of another player is different from the DM, because a good DM, in my opinion, a good DM is not antagonistic. I don't think that the DM should be on the player's side, which means that you can have like, encounters with NPCs who are run by a DM who you know is pushing your group and pushing the dynamic. That's good, but having that with a player can blur a lot more, I think. But again, I think there's room for all kinds of games as long as everyone comes into that on the same page. I feel like
Session Zero is very important.
Session Zero is like same page documents, like anything like that. And also just like having the proactive stuff to establish that from the get-go, and then reactive tools, whether it's like, yeah, pause cards are one of them, but you've got other tools where you can make, you know, just having those tools and encouraging them to use, players to use it, more importantly, so you can actually keep lines on that and people respect that. Yeah, there's interesting things you can do with PvP, because kind of talking about stakes before, like anything I say should not necessarily be taken as universal, but I certainly want like the ability to have stakes in clashes or conflict between characters, which is not necessarily the same as true PvP. And having a campaign that is geared to allow for more direct clashes can be interesting if it gives more room for that to play out. But I know that is it's a difficult balance, because there's always this... it's often unspoken, but what should be a spoken sort of contract or expectation between the group is that like the player characters can disagree, but firstly, like everyone, like the players have to be fine with each other. Yeah. And also like, you want to know that the actual, whatever you're playing is going to move forward in some way, whether it's the most meandery or the most railroady campaign, whatever. You want to know that there's not going to be any you want to know that you can handle any in-character disagreement that's so great that you'd be like, okay, so why are these characters like working together now? Like, yeah. that's the line usually. And I genuinely, like campaigns that set up to explore that explicitly, that's really cool, but you have to be like, that has to be a specific thing. And I think it's hard to have like a good, you know, sort of multi big arc like campaign where that is a possibility that doesn't pull away from it too often. There's an anecdote which I really like from a game that I ran in 3rd edition, actually, which I, again, looking at it now, I'm like, I would not do this now. Like, I would handle this very differently, because I don't think I succeeded on those metrics of having everyone on the same page. But it has been it led to a memorable moment for the players, which I think everyone, my impression is everyone is fine with, and I hope that it's the case. Like, I don't think it was a safety issue, but also like I look at that and go like, yeah, that's not wise. Which is that it was a sort of seasonal campaign with you know, the season one arc, that kind of thing. It ended with a character essentially who was sent to destroy a particular MacGuffin. While the party were defending it, they get offered power by Orcus, famously. Not nice.
Always a good.
Yeah. And they basically, there were two characters in the party who I thought might take it. One was like, it's power, that's good. But the other one was like, you're a bit of a sneaky person, and you might. And one of them ended up being the one who got the offer. And they were like, yeah, fine, cool. So most of the time, that was just like, on occasional quests, I would give them an additional objective or a side objective, which led to some cool moments. Like the party are going to investigate, again, this is so long ago, I forget the details, but different magical MacGuffin in a tomb. I forget what their explicit goal is, but they decide not to take the thing because that will trigger the Guardian, and they don't want to actually take it. They're just trying to verify something else. Mm. The character who has the secret objective is like, we need that. Switch it for the decoy that I've been given by someone. And then the party are kind of losing their minds, going like, why is the Guardian telling us we stole the thing? No one stole the thing because they didn't see the sneaky rogue make the switch out. And then it ended with that season. There was actually a full-on turn where this character actually like backstabbed and literally killed one of the other player characters, which... And escape, because the rest of the party were like, okay, we'll kill them. And no one thought that character was getting away, but they did, because there's some lucky dice rolls. And again, I don't think I ran that very well, which I would probably not even do that in the first place now. And if I did, I would have a very different approach to it. Mm. But I will say that like, it's still like the players who are involved in that to this day are like, whenever that character's name comes up, there's this clench and like fist shake of the sky. So like, again, I do not advocate running it the way I did, but like, it led to some interesting dynamics that I would be interested to explore if I'd had the tools at the time to do so better.
I can speak from my experience as a player that it is sometimes quite enjoyable to have a character that's just universally hated because of the trial. I totally agree with you. I think if it's done well, it can work really effectively, but it's always a risk.
Yeah,
especially when, and this is not to be disparaging to new players in any way, but there is, it takes a bit of time, I guess, to kind of know the unwritten rules of basically, there's a difference between having character conflict and then just stabbing everybody and robbing everyone the time.
Yeah. I think that's completely valid. And I think that's, again, and it's another argument for making those unwritten things written or verbal or whatever, you know, making the implicit explicit, because a lot of that stuff we acquire from experience and play, and that's fine. We've gained the benefit of that experience, but now we know that this is useful to actually impart to new people and say so. I've used it in games before where even I think some time ago I introduced like a guest character to a campaign, coincidentally played by the person who played the turncoat character from before, which may explain some of this behavior. But the characters in the group were very distrustful of this guest player character, and that was kind of fine, that fit the mode of where they were at, but also like this that became kind of talking about before, like it became a thing that like, okay, we're now focusing on like trying to solve whether this person's involved in a conspiracy to harm the party, when that's not the story that was going on. So the next time I used a group character, I literally gave, like, you can give direction notes to players. I think that's fine. You can say you need to, you can disagree on this. You can distrust this person as much as you want in character. You as the player need to find a way of reconciling your character's distrust, if that is the case, with the need to move this forward. Like that, like I like giving players where necessary that explicit thing where it's like, I get, it's like giving a direction. It's like you need to find a way to make this work that is both true to your character and doesn't interfere with the overall experience, which I think is good because you give them a problem to solve and you give them it's the same in writing. It's like trying to reconcile. You've got a constraint. You've got to reconcile why that is so in a way that matches your character, which is interesting because you can lead to some unexpected stuff as well.
Mm. It's important to remember that it's what my character would do is not always a precursor to a negative outcome.
Yeah, that is on the list of list of factors and things, but it's not number one. It's like not an excuse for like doing anything you want in the game either. Like it's like, you know, safety for the players is usually should be at the top. I can't think of anything that comes above that. But like being true to your character is definitely a good thing on the list, but it's also understanding that you're playing in a game with other people, and it's a lot of it is about creating, well, no, a lot of it. The fundamental part of it is creating a good experience for everybody and coming together to do something that is cooler than just like writing a book. If you want full control, write a book, like write something else. Like that's cool. I like doing that. I like having the full, like I can make all my puppets dance. Like I like what that gives, but I wouldn't, this is a different thing. It's a different experience. And that's what's so good about it is because you get lots of minds coming together and everybody has, when you're writing something, sometimes you get that little bit of like that. Hopefully you get a little bit of genius. It's like, aha, I have figured out something really neat that is an emergent cool thing that's going to make people go, ooh, but you have like five people doing that in D&D. It's right. Looking for those little bits of gold. And that just means when they come out and you're surprising those other people, it's so good. Yeah.
Fantastic. All right. Moving swiftly on. Let us roll with it. And that is a 15. So the question is, where do you start when making a character?
I have something for this. I open the player's handbook to the wizard section. No.
I do the quick start character every time.
Yeah. I wish I had the like the wizard's page number memorized because that would have.
Guess a number, and if it's right, everyone will think you're a sage.
97 of Player's Handbook. I'm going to check that later, and if I'm right, I will. I don't know. I'll have a biscuit or something. It'll be great. I almost always have some idea that I have already had. Like I'm rarely coming and going. Like I need to generate an idea from nothing, because you know I presume I'm not unique in this. Whereas I always have randomly, I will think of like, oh, it'd be cool if that film character were like a D&D character but different, or like, oh, what about this? And I'd write that down somewhere. So if I need to generate something from nothing, I'll go to that file and go, which of these fit the vibe of the campaign? But generally, I'm starting from somewhere. I have either a vague concept in broad terms, or often just like a really specific detail. Like for Ashra Beckett in Corrupted with Adventures Wanted, I had the idea some time ago of like, what if, like, what, how do you make a necromancer not this sort of stereotypically evil, horrible thing? And what about a culture where like this is seen as a good thing, like the dead live in service of living, like it's a thing you do for a time, and your body lives on in some way, and like the honoring of that. And I drifted from that concept because that wasn't appropriate to the campaign, and there's other sort of sensitivities around that. But I sort of took from that, like, how do you tell a different story about a necromancer? So having whatever I have as a hook, I start with that, and then I start to flesh it out. So I usually look for, try and distill the concept firstly, so with like marrying the whatever idea I have, whatever I want to play, and what I know about the campaign, because it's always better to match theme and vibe and everything else, just because it's more productive and it's better that way. And then I usually start building it out. Like I usually go with like one of my good tools is like I think I kind of have three different sort of tools I use to help flesh it out. Often it'll just flow out and I'll just like, okay, cool, I just have a bunch of stuff that fits with this. But if I'm struggling or if I need to pin down specific things, I'll look at like what secrets do they have, which is I usually go for like, okay, what's a minor secret, what's a major secret, and what's a secret that I know that they don't, like about themselves usually, which is a good way of, it's like, I mean, if nothing else, they don't have to be, they can function as reveals, which is quite nice. They can function as knives, if you're familiar with like the knife theory thing from Reddit, which is like the idea of handing your DM sharp objects to create interesting story opportunities slash stab you with. So they can function as reveals like that, or they can just be ways of getting you to know the character better. And I particularly like the one of like, what do I know that they don't? Like, what is the thing there? That's one thing. And then the other things I use are, I usually go for like sort of ideals or like credo type stuff. Like I usually go for about five things where I go for like declarative statements, like I believe X, or like, I mean, for Agen Asher is one of the recent ones I'm thinking of, where it's like at the time, her, one of her things is like, honor the dead. Mm. And living, you know, the living can take care of themselves, that kind of thing. Like these kind of statements where they can be role-playing pillars. They're good things to refer back to give yourself an anchor. And all of this stuff is a precursor to actually playing it. So it will all drift. And it'll all, things you write down on the document will not stick if you find you can't play them. They are a good thing to sort of build a base from. And one of the big things...
Process of the most recent... How did you build an ethical necromancer?
So I think part of that as well, the third tool is possibly the most important here for this, which is the... what question am I trying to answer? Like, I think in Hamlet's Hit Points, I think Robin Sloane's book, I'm now confused. I'm not sure what you're talking about. Hamlet's Hit Points, which is a book about one of these kind of things. I think they have this idea of like the dramatic question or the heroic ethos, which is quite a thing I like using, which is like, what question are you trying to answer through this character's arc, or what do they represent? And then with Asher, with the ethical necromancer, it was like, can someone who has what is by all accounts a villainous backstory, like this person, like if you were reading this in a book, this would be a classic villain, like, you know, that kind of thing. Can they ever be anything else? Like, can they be something else? So I started from that, and that predicated some things like, they have to have some of the trappings of this, like, you know, from many perspectives they look like a villain. That fit with the campaign. There was some sort of feedback there with, like, you know, it was going to involve the Arcane Brotherhood and other things like that, so it made sense for a wizard character to be part of that. To me anyway, which is like that kind of thing, like, okay, they're working for a definitely shady, possibly actually evil organization. In how do you then looking for the ways to play against type of that, because if you just lean into that, then you just got an evil necromancer and that's a different thing. So like looking for ways that, like, you know, under the, like, why do they do this, like, they could have talking about reconciling how can this be true and this be true about this character. How can they work for an evil organization if they're not really that way? So it's like that gave rise to character traits like actually does care about people, comes across as like proper, like, imperious and in charge and looking no bullshit kind of thing, but actually does have the well-being of her people in mind, and there's sort of that kind of underlying softness or that underlying of sense of other reasons for being here, other things that go into making this character who's ended up in this position that maybe they don't like that much under the surface. So most of building a character comes down to finding the right questions to ask myself and then trying to, if not answer them, then like have some thoughts on how to start asking them in the campaign, because that's, again, you don't want to know everything from the get-go, but also you want to know enough to give a springboard.
Absolutely. You got that foundation to build from. And it sounds like there's quite a lot of conflict and nuance going there.
Yeah, I think particularly, yeah. Yeah.
When you're looking to build a character, how much knowledge do you like to have of the, and obviously this will vary depending on the campaign setting, but how much knowledge do you like to have about the sort of the culture and the lore and so forth in order to fit the character into that world? Or do you build sort of your archetypal character and then try and fit the world around?
Yeah, it's a bit of both. I think certainly when I'm DMing, I've rarely produced enough of a world-building doc of scale enough to give everyone the granular detail, and actually that's in many ways better. I think from the DM side, leaving room for those things is good, and from the player side, having those hooks into the world is good. So both work really, really well. And there's some stuff around, so prepping for Seekers of Eltrod Buried, there were some elements that came out of like the players, the things the players put forward that I was like, okay, I had a role as a DM, I had something in my head like, okay, there is a character who needs to fill this role, like I have an idea for who this is in the story, but I don't know who that is yet. And that's when I went looking through the players' tools, like what the players handed me, and like, okay, that fits, like using a thing from their backstory, using something there connects really well. So as a player, I like hooking it in where possible, but you just don't always have access to that information. So often I will, if I absolutely go, okay, this character only works if X is true, I will check with the DM, like, can X be true? Can they have this backstory element and that be consistent with the world you're making? And usually the answer is yes at that stage. And oftentimes I'm like, okay, this is the I need some detail that conveys this. Here's my intention when I'm creating the character. I'm sure I had an example with Ashra. I think even Ashra, like, I didn't know initially where Ashra's like hometown was. Like, it wasn't important per se to me, other than it be, you know, what I needed was, I need a city where there are sort of machinations, all this kind of thing. And then it's like, okay, well, the Arcane Brotherhood's in play. Mm. Arcane Brotherhood based in Luskan, so that's a fit there. Okay, cool. So I got that from the rest of the DM. So I will usually leave gaps and then try and fill those gaps with the DM if it's important. Or in some cases, like, if I don't need to know the answer when I'm making the character, particularly if it's like arc stuff, where I'm like, okay, like a home game I'm playing with my kind of character concept there is the unwitting warlock, who's just a nice boy from the village. He wouldn't, if you offered him a you know, fiendish pact or a fey pact, he wouldn't take it. Like, he's nice and doesn't feel a need for aspiration in that kind of way. He doesn't want to complicate his life, but he starts getting these powers, and that my idea was like, okay, so he's for whatever reason, he has not made an explicit pact yet, and these powers are flowing to him with the intention that in the future he will be asked explicitly, and by that point he might say yes because he has been immersed in this power so long and his life has changed to the point where he needs it to survive. And I don't know if he would say yes at that point, and I'm like, okay, that's the moment I'm driving for, therefore I don't need to know who his patron is, but I have a sense in my head it is like this character from this book, or it represents these things like shadows and darkness and ice and cold. Like, I'll give you that, but you find whatever fits your world, the world, like, and feel free to surprise me. I've given the DM a sense of like,
here are the
what
seeds,
I'm going for.
Plant them in your
belly. Exactly, right. And like, yeah. Here's what I have in my head, here's how I'm going to be playing it. So we want to be consistent enough with that, but also like, take what I've asked for and see what comes out. I like those kind of things where you're trusting the DM and surrendering that kind of control, because it's cool to be surprised. Like, it's cool to go, hey, I want this kind of, you know, it's cool to be surprised while also asking for what you want, which is ideal.
You begin the collaborative process right at the beginning.
Exactly. Yeah, I'd say that to players. It's like, work out what you want to ask your DM for and then surrender control of it. Like, let them meet you somewhere, not even in the middle, somewhere over there where you didn't expect.
Yeah, I am guilty of the 5-page backstory, mainly as a way of sort of slightly justifying why I might have certain items. It's not quite the full Henderson, but it's like, well, it's the backstory. Come on, it's what my character would do. I'm a better player now than I was when I began.
Fair enough. Yeah,
certainly less. You know, there's nothing wrong with being a power gamer. Definitely nothing wrong with it, but it's nice to have a little blend of the spices, I think.
Yeah.
It's better to be a nice...
I like being an effective character. I like being able to live the role that I've chosen for the party effectively, because that is generally more fun. But yeah, that's it. Yeah.
Live the role, but don't optimal. Live every role.
Yeah, that's, yes. Leave room.
Yeah, fantastic. That's brilliant. That's about all we have time for. Is there anything that you want to shout out?
Now, as I mentioned before, all my stuff's under NDA and I really want to shout about it, but I can't.
That's all right, just say it, we'll just bleep it out, or just move your lips and we'll just add some bleeps.
I now can't think of anything convincing to say that's not actually under NDA, so I'm like, okay.
I'll just act shocked. I can't believe they're making a third one. Oh well.
I mean, the more you hear. But you can follow. You can find my stuff on georgelockett.com, which is 2 T's. But mostly, I'm on Twitter at Master George. You can find me on there. I'll tweet stuff when I have stuff out, or just shout about cool things, or just retweet dog pictures. So follow me on there.
Well, thank you everyone for joining us and being part of the show. If you enjoyed tonight, we do play D&D games every Monday from 6 PM GMT, 10 AM Pacific time, and on Tuesdays from 7 PM GMT, 11 AM Pacific time. All of our shows are streamed at twitch.tv/rolltogetherRPG, and you can find all of our content archived at youtube.com/rolltogetherRPG. There are also podcast versions of all our shows available everywhere. Search for Roll Together RPG. Massive thank you to our D20 Club on Patreon. There'll be a link in chat now. Do join them. Every penny helps us make all of the content that we do. And a big thanks again to all our sponsors, Hero Forge, Ultra Pro, and Elderwood Academy, and our supporters, D&D Beyond, Warriors of Waterdeep, and Level Up Dice. We're all over social media as Roll Together RPG. Thank you for joining us, and stay classy at the table.